This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 28th of October, 1953. The title of this lecture is Case Reports, SOP-8C, SOP-8L. This tape is 59 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Arrow Productions. Please note, this tape ends abruptly, as did the original master recording.
This is the October 28th, and we've had three cases actually into here as demonstration cases, and I handled one of them just for the good and adequate reason, as I just wanted to size up this case. Thought this case might be real interesting, and so it could be. That's these little girls I was telling you about. And yesterday, Mr. Davis, who has written over here several times, wondering whether or not he couldn't be processed. Paying pretty clear, by the way. I mean, he's perfectly willing to pay and all that sort of thing. He came in. He's an art painter of some sort or another, designer. The girl in the office got him mixed up with a fellow coming up with wallpaper. I haven't seen this report or heard from them. It says October 27th, processed by me for 1 hour. Reaction time is very slow. That is a masterpiece of understatement. His reaction time was slow. It was detectable. From 1 minute for a straight wire. 1 minute for a straight wire.
From 1 minute.
Yeah. Oh, longer. 1 minute longer. Yeah. He exteriorized readily. I was only then able to get him on the meter satisfactorily. Assessment taken, and creative processing done so that he could handle Mother and God. He held corners and so forth, and reaction time improved by over 1,000%. You see any marked change in his handling of the mock-up? That's what you call the body. Marked change?
Oh, marked change.
Alert.
Very much.
Did he get up like he knew he was going to get up, or did he get up like when he first came in, he got up and then found out that he had stood up?
Well, he went lying.
Good. That's fine. This boy is a caved-in artist, caved-in painter. And that's just real fine.
The exteriorization, I kept him on quite some time on that paper again. And
what was the valuable exercise?
Exteriorization from place to place and position to position.
Oh, you mean change? Let's get these processes right now. Exteriorization isn't a process.
Well, I'm sorry, step
one. Yeah, that's right. It's not a process. And the other, from place to place, is change processing, just as a designation which I've been using. Change of space processing. Got that? Now, exteriorization shouldn't be put down in your book as a process. It's not a process. It is a natural condition which we're restoring to a pre-clear. And when fellows get to a point where they're popping in and out of bodies, God help us. It means that they've got to own them, they've got to hide them and protect them, and they're real bad off when they're in bodies. I mean, they're just terrible conditions. Horrible. Practically nothing can be done about it. Yeah, well, yeah. Now we have in this very interesting. I didn't mean to correct there on that. Just I want to straighten out that point real quick. That's very good. Very good. Very good work. Thank you. I've got to start beating up the brush now for a few PCs. How long did this session take?
Well, he only stayed 1 hour.
Well, it took an hour. I mean, it took a long time on the session. Adjust to that. Long session. just get your gunshots in there so that the muzzle velocity is high enough to adjust to the technique. You know, actually, auditors will say, well, this is a tough case, which means it ought to take a lot of hours. And then they will sit down and figure out, actually, how it can take that many hours. They're going around the front. All right, so much for that case report. This morning, it's about time that I lowered the boom on you with regard to a process which is we have been fooling around with, but which is very serious and is the process and is the key process. One might say that this is the announcement, this isn't ultimate, but this is an announcement of, as far as you'd care to be, pretty close to top of ladder for this universe and bodies and exteriorization, all that sort of thing. Now, there's some of you people been worrying a little bit because you weren't flipping happily and readily out of the body and flying about the place and seeing everything in a beautiful roseate or golden glow. And some of you have been worrying about this. Well, you haven't worried me. Merely because we here learn something about human beings and learn something about life and so forth. There's no sense in ruining, as Burke said early in the course, all these beautiful cases. But I've got to start beating up the brush here because we're going to be fresh out of cases here in a short time. You see what a resistance Homo sap will put up unless you practically turn 16-inch guns on him. We have been talking about SOP-8, and we've been using SOP-8L. 8L is a learning process. You can run this on a preclear just as that, and you learn something about life. Much more important, it's an educative process as far as we're concerned. If you're going to do anything about Mr. Homo sapiens, you would certainly better know how he operates. Now, that sounds very silly to say that. That sounds asinine. Me to say, well, in order to do something about man, you've got to learn something about man. It's silly for me to say that. It's too obvious. Only it's terribly original. It is painfully original in man's annals, archives. You don't find it. In order to do something about it. Now, you had a fellow by the name of Alexander Pope, one of the earlier tapes I razzle-dazzled up poetry by attributing Gray's elegy to Alexander Pope and so forth. I was immediately assured after the lecture by two or three of the auditors that Gray's elegy had been written by Gray. I get too subtile once in a while. Sometimes I get so subtile I don't know what I'm saying either, so it's even. I get lost, but when I open the box, it's a big surprise. Anyway, when we look into the annals and archives, we find Pope's magnificent piece. It's much greater, that poem, than Zeno's Apatheia. Guarantee that if you brought this poem into a sick room, your patient would die. It's guaranteed. Work that way. He says, the proper study... Seek not for God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. Nobody took his advice. He didn't take his advice either. He goes on then, stanza after stanza, saying how it's hopeless. It's a gorgeous poem. You ought to get it and read it sometime. It's man's, the highest tone man ever reached in the study of himself. Really fine, fine piece of poetry. Scans every line, rhymes too. We have then back on the time track just about that, study of man. I have no idea how difficult it's been to study man. I can tell you now, take down my hair a little bit amongst us girls. It was just incredible. It was impossible to find out, as far as I could see, just where we were going with this, because cases kept showing up which were worse off than cases I had ever seen. And cases were terribly bad off, and they kept moting. And the wonderful thing about it was how the people that I have seen walk through clinics and through my processing rooms and so forth, how people could still operate. This is fantastic. So we could just assume that man will operate. He will operate below anything else is operational level. If you got way down below anything's possible operational level, you would reach a high-toned man. That's about it. I mean, it's real grim. Now, I've had you running computations. I've had you running all kinds of circuitry and shown you this and that, so on. We could go on for some time with this sort of thing because it's a beautifully complex problem, and you can hit every part of it, and it looks beautiful, and it looks very convincing and so forth. Well, we could go on doing this. It just shows you how hard man will fight to keep a game going and how many things he will hide to keep a game going. It actually isn't very necessary for you to go out and clear all of mankind suddenly at a swift swoop, for the excellent reason that if you did, you'd spoil the game. You'd just ruin it. Ruin it utterly. Capitalists wouldn't have any slaves anymore. Communists wouldn't be able to parasite on the workers. You just wouldn't have any game going at all. Medical doctors, you give them no pain at all. I mean, think of what you deny a doctor, a surgeon. Blood flying around the place, and arteries beating, and the terrific drama of going down and showing the appendices to the, showing them to the relatives, saying, just in time. I've seen a doctor actually spatter blood on himself so that he could go down and see the relatives, saying the operation was just in time. Think of the drama that you would spoil. The only thing that happens to this drama is after a while it gets so dramatic that they can't tolerate it anymore, so they say that's actual, and that's really real, and then nobody can tolerate the drama, so nobody can have any drama, and it just gets dull. Now, the only thing you would really do, if you just cleared everybody across the boards, a full sweep, you'd spoil the game. Well, remember, the game gets spoiled in another way. The game gets spoiled by arbitrations of let's restrict. And everybody has agreed on let's restrict, and that's the one thing they have agreed on. We have to restrict to have a game. And then they get too good at it. They get to a point where there's no motion. And there's where the game is. So actually, all you really desire is just to bring up the level of the game, not to knock out the game. You'd be surprised how boring it is sitting out nowhere for a long time. Very boring. No action, nothing like that. Of course, action is compulsive, you understand. You go high enough up tone scale, and you're perfectly happy to be serene. That's a funny, redundant statement, but there's many other way to state it in that language. So the technique I'm giving you now actually spoils your game to some slight extent. Beautiful idea. The fellow's awfully aberrated, and we have to do something for him. We could have the terrible drama of dashing into the relatives and saying, well, he only requires... We saw a psychiatrist. We saw a psychiatrist last night, a beautiful play. I mean, it was gorgeous. It opens up with a psychiatrist telling somebody, and it was on television. I got that up pretty good, though. You can almost see a picture. If you use your imagination. Anyway, this psychiatrist opens it up by telling the fellow, who is terribly discouraged, that it will take a long time. Well, he shouldn't really. He should realize something can probably be done, possibly, but it's going to take a long time. He explains this to his patient, and that sets the note of the picture. And then he goes down and finds this girl who won't talk and can't communicate, and who's arrested for murder or something of the sort, and finally gets her to talk. And he runs half of the engram and gets her up to a terrific emotional charge, which is just about ready to spill the grief on the charge, and so forth. But all he wanted it for was evidence for the court, so he turns around and gives it over to the court. He leaves the engram half run. Then they go away saying, she recounted how she'd murdered the fellow, you see, and she was just getting down into a beautiful release of grief when he just quit, you see, and ran up and told the judge what the score was, and so everything was fine. This is real sloppy process. Real stinking. Right in the middle of the engram, while she's running the engram, He says, hold on to yourself. Isn't that great? I mean, so we can assume from this movie, which was a factual movie and so forth, that they had good technical direction, and we can assume that this sort of thing occasionally happens, that a psychiatrist does not know Dianetics, much less Scientology. We can assume that. Plus, it's an incredible fact. I hardly feel you'd accept it for a moment, but it's true. And then he finishes up the picture telling with a statement that the girl may recover sometime or another. Well, I don't know quite what this is all about. You see, the girl may recover sometime or another, when the fact of the matter is that he had the engram half run. You see that? He has it half run, and then he says she may recover sometime or another. Well, that is a beautiful example, and the only reason I'm ringing in a television on you is just to demonstrate that that's the way they keep the game going. They do the right thing halfway and then hope that something else will happen. See? Cause and effect. Don't dare take on a full cause. If you took on a full cause, you ruin the game. Well, does a process exist which gunshots occasion exteriorizes people rather easily? Yes. But you had a good time with computational processes. And I hope that with these processes you have gained an understanding of what Homo sapiens is all about, how you exteriorize him, and how he resists it, and what he will get into, and what he thinks. Because believe me, after this it's going to seem kind of unreal to you that he would go through all of this amount of trouble. And if you start processing a pre-clear, and he starts telling you this and that and so forth, it's all right in processing them, just to shoot him down in his tracks with a very fast technique. But remember, he's alive. He's out there on the street. That street isn't a processing room. You have to have some sort of an understanding of what makes him tick. For two reasons. One, so your insatiable curiosity will not lead you into numerous traps set by into tremendous numbers of insincerities rigged up as beautiful sincerities. You get the idea. It's the guy on the street we've been learning about, the fellow in the state house, the fellow in the government, the reactions that we see about. And, well, here are two guys, and they have a couple of cars. There's one very gorgeous car, and it has run into, it's right up here at the street up here this morning. It's run into the back of a rather knocked-about Ford sedan. But this beautiful green car, brand-new car, evidently plowed in real hard. And as pointed out, and the fellow in the big new car slammed on his brakes to keep from running into the back of this other car in the rain. The nose of the big car dipped, you see, and then struck, and then, of course, came back up. You know, when they stamp their brakes for those dips. Very lousy sort of a way to build a car, by the way. You build a racing car that does that too often, you're in real trouble, because you get up there around anything that could be considered a velocity, like 150, and you have one that ducks its bonnet and does a bow, and it bows all right. It's also somersaults. But anyway, they built this big, beautiful car this way, so it does that. Its front springs aren't tense enough. So here are two wrecking trucks, and one has hold of the front car by the front bumper, and the other has hold of the back car by the back bumper, and they're trying to get these two cars apart. Well, now let's get what they're doing. At the moment we passed, the wrecking trucks, each one having solid holes on the car, with the big, beautiful new car sort of tipped up with its hind wheel slightly in the air, started to drive in opposite directions at the same time, you see, and yank and pull and bang, and you could hear pieces of bumpers coming apart and all of this sort of thing. It's very interesting. Now, as a perfect explanation, they're wrecking cars. And by Q&A, there has been a wreck. So what do you do about it? What do you do about a wreck? You do just what firemen do about a wrecked house by fire. You wreck it. See, Q&A. You can watch this identification running, and actually it affords a great many jokes. His intention, his full-spoken intention, you see, is according to what he said, what the owner understood was that he's trying to salvage these cars, you see, and bring them apart and repair them and fix them up and keep them from being further injured. That's what the owner understood. But there's no communication between the owner and the wrecking truck driver on this subject. The wrecking truck driver, I'm sure that if you questioned him very carefully on the subject, you would find him very blank about it. What was he trying to do to that car? He wouldn't give you a satisfactory answer. He'd say, well, I was trying to get him apart, of course. That's the obvious thing. Well, what is he trying to do? He's a wrecking car, so he has to wreck cars. Anyway, we have this sort of thing going on. As you see man operating, he becomes very funny. Now, as an auditor, you go much further on this, and a lot of other things become very funny to you. There's this fellow lying on a sick bed, and this beautiful sadness is going on in all directions, and the children are about to starve because Papa is dying or something like that. And this can become screamingly funny, believe me. It is very, very funny. Here's this fellow about to shove off and pick up another kid. See? Throwing all of his responsibilities to the winds. Wham! Dickens with him. And here are all these other beings, totally certain that they have to depend utterly upon this fellow who's passing away. Why do they have to depend upon him? Well, they have to depend upon him, you see, because he's leaving. It's complete idiocy. I remember one time I was driving down the road. This was in the Bible Belt. And driving down the road, it never quite hit me what they'd been about in the Bible Belt until I saw this huge, huge hearse. It was just a wonderful hearse. It must have cost $15,000 or $20,000. Most gorgeous limousine you ever saw. Better car than anybody was driving around alive in. And it was piled high with beautiful flowers, much better flowers than anybody had on his table or at any wedding. And it was followed by car after car after car, all of which were just completely crammed with weeping relatives. And I looked at this thing going along, and I couldn't restrain myself. I started, it was just one of those moments when I was carried away, and I began to laugh. Because it was so silly. This fellow, from just one sweep down the line of cars and so forth, had never in his lifetime been accorded anything even vaguely resembling respect. He had been sponged on and ruined one way or the other, and everybody, particularly the closest relatives, were real happy about all this. They were weeping and they were carrying on, and all this beautiful style was going on. To do what? Well, to put this mock up down in the ground someplace and cover it over. Honestly, it's real silly. And it had just come from an undertaking fire where the undertaker had made a better looking mock up out of it than the So all the aesthetic, the flowers, the harmony, the sympathy, everything the guy needed in his lifetime, see, that never got. He's got it now. He's dead. He's on his way. This is a sort of a brutal sort of a sarcasm or some kind of a ridicule on the part of the society, yet they never see it that way. Very, very fascinating. Man, this is fabulous. He is. People say, well, why doesn't this operating Satan go out and do something or other in Russia and so on? I know one PC I was processing was just furious with Russia beyond fury. And she kept on coming up the line, till one day it occurred to her that what on earth would she be doing for Randonity? These Russians were such beautiful game. And a bunch of overt acts on the track, one way or the other, suddenly showed up and blew. Well, as a spirit, she hung around Russia for some time before she finally got trapped in a body. And one of the Russians' penchants is to go on into the barn and all sit down greedily and burn the barn down on themselves. So she used to help them out getting into the barn. And here's this vast country that if today, if you were to put the face of Christ above it, huge visible mock-up above Russia, why the whole government would cave in and everybody would go to pieces. And if you put up signs or icons to the effect of Lenin has come back after having joined Christ and seen the light, Russia would never be able to rest again. I mean, that would finish off communism. It would just be dead. There would be no more communism. When the truth of the matter is, you see, that they've done this in the past. The Russian peasant is actually so accustomed to the rigors of living and is quite savvy, really, about the faith. He knows he's a faith. And so people come up who don't even look the least bit like the fellow that's dead, and they suddenly say, well, I'm so-and-so. And others come around and they say, they're so-and-so, too. Doesn't make any difference to anybody in Russia. Big revolt! Shoot down the government, kill everybody, burn all the barns. It's just fascinating. Some leader dies, somebody could come up right now, and if the religion was still allowed to run in Russia, that's why they're holding religion down, see, at the muzzle of a gun. Somebody could come along and say, I'm Stalin, and if Stalin had any friends, which he didn't have, the government of Russia would just go appetite over tin cup, pam. It's all it took. But actually, it takes somebody of a saintly, apathetic sort of a character to get the Russian government. You see? So this operating Satan immediately saw all these things, understood all this, and so forth, and just didn't back off from the whole problem. It just melted as a problem. It wasn't a problem. It was, look at that beautiful playing field. It's something they get up on World Affairs somewhat on the basis of, what? Burn down Yankee Stadium? It's just that silly. All right. Well, there are processes which burn down Yankee Stadium. We won't worry about those. We'll talk this morning about a process that brings a pre-clear in pretty good shape fairly fast. You've had this process. I've been talking about it all along. You've been walking around the edges of it. It changes utterly nothing I've been talking about for a long time. But you must know that SOP-8, as released, is not complete. No step listed is complete. There's just enough SOP-8 printed to do a job on psychosomatic illness and aberration and exteriorization up to a medium level of cheerfulness. That's how much SOP-8 there is up. Every one of those steps, all the way down from 1 to 7, would require, for an outline of its total possibilities, at least a large chapter in a book to give everything that you really did with the step all the way through. Those are model steps, and the most elementary form of each step is the part of SOP-8 that's been printed. Just a model, just an elementary summary. Somebody could very cleverly take one of these steps and expand them and so forth, and he'd see where they led. If he just carried it out just the step and never figured it, didn't figure any further, just carried the step out to reductio ad absurdum all the way down the line, just completely exhausted it as a step, he would see that step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, step 4, well, as I said, it's got a sleeper in it. Level of acceptance, how you have to waste. People can't even waste some of those things, you know that? Take as rough subjects as there are in that list. Some of the even the rougher subjects, some people can't waste them.
This lecture is continued on side 2 of this cassette.
Somebody this very short time ago trying to waste boredom. I swear I could just hear his brains cracking. He was trying to waste boredom. It was utterly impossible. And then he got around to a way of where one didn't have to have boredom, and he called that wasting. This was an impossible problem for him. Because I just started him in at his wrong level on the tone scale, and I just did it on purpose. And just pushed him into the wrong level of the tone scale, and he ran up against a blank wall. Just as though he'd hit a concrete wall with a tank. And he just, you could just hear his brains crack and his ridges creak. He was having an awful time. What he had to waste was apathy. Then he had to waste grief and fear, hate, antagonism, and then he could have wasted boredom with great ease. But we don't go into that sort of thing because it's very hard to get people to read anything that's very long. And also, there isn't any sense in putting out that much information in one fell swoop. I haven't been holding back information. It's partly laziness on my part. There is no significance to doing this. It's beyond the fact that it isn't all there. But it's workably there. And follow me. On a step one, says drill, dangerous places, do this, do that, and so forth. Also, I don't know whether it says it in the present issue, but it says earlier that you do all these on a Thetan exteriorized. Do all these steps. I don't know whether SOP-8 is printed right now, makes that clear or not. You get the Thetan outside and then you do all these steps. All right, let's take step two. Step one, as printed, merely says you take him to all these other places and you do this and you do that. And so on. Well, it doesn't go into change processing. It doesn't go into shifting him from one viewpoint to another viewpoint and building up his viewpoint and so forth. But a fellow would understand that if he read the factors. I mean, all I've been trying to do is make sure the information didn't get lost, to be revolved. Two. Step two. Obviously, if a fellow just kept mocking himself up, if he was in pretty good shape, well, he would exteriorize. If he's in pretty good shape. But you can use step two for a total exteriorization. How? Well, you have to know about anchor points. You're not going to run any real charge off of the case one way or the other by putting up one anchor point. You don't have space there. You have a line. Why do you think people have communication lines to other people? Is this because, you see, the whole universe would disintegrate if there was two of each of you. If you had two bodies, and if there was somebody just exactly like you, go to the same place, you'd get a meltdown. Now, you've seen match terminaling? Well, the two terminals disappear. I mean, they just melt each other up, that's all. That's because you have a line between those two, and you've got the rudiments of a plane, which is at least part of space, but a line. A line is too rudimentary, so if you've got one individual, and he's very different from every other individual, naturally all you'll get between individuals is lines. And this makes energy. You can compound the lines up and pack them down and stuff them into things and make energy out of them and all sorts of things. You just don't go around being two identical people. Twins, for instance, have lots of fun, but that's merely because they're rare. If you ever wanted to look into the mental makeup of a twin, if you ever had twins as preclears, you're in for quite a time. They're just melting each other down all the time. It's fabulous. They're meshed and merged, and their individuality is shot, and one of them hurts herself, and the other one gets hurt, too. And it's fabulous. I mean, they may be miles, miles, miles apart, and one of them's in an auto wreck, and the other one develops a headache. A motor report's too close. So being an individual is in part a prevention of what? Of melting the whole universe down. That's about what it amounts to. Don't have two of everything. That makes them less valuable. Now, tells you that just putting out one mock-up then doesn't answer all the conditions of step two. I was telling you now, self-analysis yesterday, get two mock-ups. Did you find that very interesting? Very interesting on a case level. Well, it'd get a hell of a lot more interesting than that if you put up your body eight times and made space out of it. Fellow's got terrific certainty on his body. It's the first anchor point he'll get. So just put it up eight times. Some very interesting things with that. Now, what about these people that the fellow's worried about? He knows there's a witch from Haiti hanging around, or he knows he has a couple of friends or something of the sort to keep pestering him when he's asleep. And he knows he's haunted by demons or something of the sort. He's real certain of it, isn't he? Well, for God's sakes, take the most certain thing of the case and make anchor points out of it. And by that I mean at least 4 points space and really 8 points space. You make 8 points space with great ease.
He's certain of it. All right, let him make space out of it. So he's just lost his child or something of the sort. He's real certain of that child. He's never been more certain. As a matter of fact, you ask him closely as he's doing mock-ups, an image of the child will keep flipping in and out on him. Be blackness and the child and blackness, and then every once in a while you run into this image again. Remember, invalidation is make anchor points uncertain. Well, he's got a certain anchor point there. And that's beautiful stuff to make space out of. So let's just have the child around in 8 points of space, and his concern about it will then. It's a very simple process. Somebody says, I knew this girl, she left me, and my emotions have been off ever since. It's not, doesn't follow that you can't turn these on just because he says they're off. He's quite certain of this girl. He doesn't get a visio of her. But he will, very shortly, make space with her. A lot of these things, well, you don't have to have any emotion involved in it. No emotion at all involved. See how that works? You take things of which the guy is certain, and you make anchor points out of him. He'll fly out into that space. He'll get all mixed up with life and so forth, and he will eventually pin his hopes on one type of anchor point. He's always got one anchor point, two anchor points, three anchor points. Well, you make space out of them. And the problems concerning these things will blow, but that's almost immaterial. The point is you're starting to exteriorize it. That's step two. Just keep it running all the way out. Most certain thing he's certain of is his own body. Now, there's the entering wedge on the process. So just make put eight bodies, put him around eight times. When he can finally do this stably, he'll exteriorize. All right. Let's go down to step three. And here, at step three, is plain unadulterated murder. It says space station. Now you're running concepts in brackets. That's all you have to know about it. Yeah? You run concepts in brackets. You just do a bracket. Actually, it amounts to a bracket of six on space. It's a bracket of six that finally works out. I'll show you what it is in a minute, the extra bracket. But we need an extra point. Just space. And now we reduce that all the way, and we find that we run a bracket of holding the corners of the room. Doesn't matter whether you do two or eight of them. It's best to do eight of them. Your PC will all of a sudden get blazingly bright, clear, golden anchor points sitting all over the place. He's liable to go around saying, gee, I got anchor points. How long did it take you to do it? Well, it didn't take you very long to do it. Everything is dark. There's a coal scuttle. Next thing you know, he's got bright anchor points. He sits them all over his house like St. Elmo's fire. He's never seen anything like this. He's fascinated. Now, somebody comes along and they haven't got good perception. I've given you some class demonstrations here, notable for the slowness of the process. But very interesting that these class demonstrations pick up perception. Very interesting. One yesterday, pick up reaction time. Gave you another one yesterday, finding the nothing at the end of the communication line. That is the search for the other terminal. And that is the biggest search anybody makes in the universe, the search for that confounded lost anchor point. And the only reason they're stuck in the universe at all is they're trying to find that lost anchor point. Did you ever see anybody lose a collar button? Well, you just keep at it and at it and at it, and there are about five other collar buttons sitting in that doggone bureau. And he'll just keep looking and worrying and wondering and fussing about that lost collar button. That's what people are doing with the missing terminal at the end of the communication line. He actually has an impulse to make things valuable, which makes them scarce. You make things something valuable, you've got to have few of it, believe me. So, his idea then is the thing that has the fewest of anything is the thing which the most is lost. The fewest is where it was but isn't. And that's really upsetting. He wouldn't stay in this universe at all if he didn't think he'd lost something. The fellow says, do you want to take another airplane flight? And the other fellow says, no, I didn't lose anything up there. The hell he didn't. He's got things lost all over space. He's lost them on purpose, so he can surprise himself when he finds them. Then he's forgotten the mechanism. He has a hell of a time after a while. He thinks he's lost, too. He goes on down the line. Great speed.
Well, it's just a question of anchor points, isn't it?
Anchor points are terminal points. Doesn't matter. There's a lot of classes of anchor points. There are anchor points, dimension points, terminal points, and merely mass points. You know, you just got a lot of points, and you throw them all together, and that makes a mass, and then you can make a bigger anchor point. But every point in the big anchor point's mass. Call them anchor points, and you're just as happy as dimension points. That is points. They make space. The whole problem blew apart at the moment we cracked a definition for space. This utterly, inanely simple definition for space was missing in the technology and knowledge of man. Utterly missing. Now, he could have had that definition, you see, without blowing up the universe. He didn't have to be this obtuse. And first, he didn't have to be this stupid as to pretend to have a science of physics that depends upon space, utterly dependent upon space, and then ignore the fact that it's dependent upon space and study energy. That's really, don't look at it, isn't it? And then it keeps talking about space, though. Things drop through space, space, space. Everywhere you go in a physics textbook, you discover that they're using space, 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 space. That's all they're talking about. And the physicist's main worry is he boils down atoms and gets more and more atoms, and they get less and less and so forth, is that the fact that he finds smaller units all the time. And so on, and he's running out. He's right now, he's getting frantic. Because if he can't find a smaller unit than he's found, he'll have to face the fact that he's looking at space. See that? He can't do that. So you get, by the way, your nuclear physicists of today are crazy. It was the fastest route to insanity, the study of nuclear physics, if you were going to take it seriously. You find them dropping down tone scale like bombs. Why these nuclear physicists are joining the Committee for the Enforcement of Communist Liberty in America and recommending enemy aliens for employment on secret projects. Just, boy, they're really on their way. In beautiful condition they are for an auditor. How can anybody be that bad off and still live? You, to understand this and appreciate this, you'd have to know some of these boys intimately. If you do, then you know what I'm talking about. But you haven't seen on the streets anybody as bad off as a nuclear physicist. The common concourse of man, the delicatessens and so forth, you just don't find anybody that bad off. Why? He is avoiding the last avoidance, which immediately tells you that his case must be in terrible condition. He's down there to a point of where he is doing a must avoid but can't avoid. And that's like must reach but can't reach. And so it develops an insanity. And these boys are mad as hatters. The one piece of technology which they have to resolve nuclear physics and to resolve their own madness is just that an idiotically simple definition of space, a viewpoint of dimension. They cannot admit that there is a viewpoint. Everything is impartial, you see. There's dimension, but they can't figure out what makes space because they can't admit the existence of the viewpoint. So the whole subject is lost to them because they can't admit livingness, which is source, you see. So they're looking at the ultimate effect of livingness and are reaching as far away from livingness as they can reach. Well, just of course, in this whole statement, you've got why you get technical societies just going by the boards. My God, a technical society, if any of you rehearsed any of your space opera lately. Holy God. They have a big tower in the town, you know, and the fellow thinks the hospital fought to the government and goes down and turns himself in for an electronic shock treatment. Why? Well, he knows it's picked up on the tower. How does he know it's picked up on the tower? Well, he's been told so. With a few thousand volts behind it. If you think a hostile thought or an unsocial thought with regard to the town or the government of the town or the people connected therein, you see, it says here, in small electrons, you have to go turn yourself into the local police station. They just simply walk in and turn themselves in, saying, well, I thought a hospital thought this one. Okay, sit in the cabinet on the left, and the technician presses a couple of buttons and depersonalizes them completely. In other words, takes everything they've got and throws it away and put them in a new doll or something that goes out and shovels. I don't know how they invent work for these people to do is what's most interesting, because all the machinery does all the work. This is a technical society, and that's the kind of a society which an engineer creates. Now, you talk to engineers about the human mind, he says, it's subject to error, he says. UNIVACs and ENIACs, he says, they're much more reliable. What's his level of certainty? You just never happen to tell him, you see. You just don't ever bother to tell him this one, because it's a crusher. He can't quite avoid it. What dreamed up the UNIVAC and ENIAC? If you force him down onto it, he will eventually have to admit that the human mind did. And this makes the human mind pause. He either goes immediately into apathy or goes into rage. You give him a rough time when you do this sort of thing to him. I don't know a single engineer working with this sort of thing who isn't bluntly in the early stages of neurosis, and the bulk of them I have found have been in the late stages of neurosis. All of them are having tremendous trouble in the second dynamic particularly. They're in bad shape, poor guys. All right. These lads, of course, because they're figure all the time, and because they have gone past the point of any conscience with regard to anybody else, they say they're not alive, so they know nobody else is, you see. They've gone past the point of conscience. What they dream up as a society is an inverted level. And so you get societies composed of God and so on. This society is on the verge of sinking into a technical society. And that's no game at all. That's what you call no game. It's all electrons and everything. Everything's push button and automatic and so on. Okay. Spaceation then embraces space. Space is simply a viewpoint of dimension. And it carried out as a process. Well, just not cases, just Flinders. Because it makes the case admit that space is caused by a viewpoint. And it's a process that has just as much duress on it as an electronic shock if you run it hard and tough. And it doesn't matter a damn how you run this process, I hate to tell you. As long as you run it in an orderly sequence, you can be as tough as you want, as mean as you want, interrupt anybody as often as you want, and really boot them around. Because the process simply runs out every lock that you put in. Just that's fast. And it gets the guy over the biggest hang-ups he's got, which is dead X, without thinking about him, the overt-act motivator sequence, and his unwillingness to free other beings. His fear of other beings is such that he's unwilling to free them. And so he hates to confront a solved problem on the subject of the freedom of others. Now, how do you run a space station in brackets? I'll come back to that in a moment, and we'll cover the rest of SOP8. Acceptance level processing is a learning process. The PC finds out that he's been trying to get himself and get mock-ups accepted, and it shows him what kind of a mock-up is acceptable. Sick little boy was all that was acceptable to his parents. Would you say, what kind of childhood you have? Oh, I don't know, I was sick my whole childhood. You say, well, mock up a sick little boy. Mock up a sick little boy, sick little boy. Sick. Oh, I can't get any mock-ups, you'll say. I really once in a while get one, but I mean, I'm a sick little boy. It's very hard. Oh, come on, get the sick little boy. Oh, yeah, well, I get that all right now, yeah. Well, who's accepting it? My parents. You say, lock it up again. Yeah, the only ones who do accept it's my parents. Lock it up again. Okay. You know, all I wanted around was a sick little boy? To hell with it. See, that's kind of an immediate sort of reaction you'll very often get off of a frequent. He learns that a medium state of sickness, amongst other things, is what is acceptable to the society. The society doesn't accept somebody who's well. And you can't tell him this because it's just evaluating. Well, just get him to run this process. Now put yourself up as mediumly sick. not objectionably sick. You can put that up a few times. Now get other people putting it up. All of a sudden you see, you know, the whole society runs that way, doesn't it? It's kind of silly, but it's true. Everybody's got to be just a little bit sick, so they're not too dangerous. In other words, he learns also that he has to hold back his own brightness, his own recognition, his own lookingness. You can teach him this with acceptance level processing. Now, let's have what kind of lookingness, we were running this yesterday, what kind of lookingness is acceptable to Papa and what kind is to Mama? Normally, if the case is really bad off, he's come on, always come up with this. Gee, no kind at all! The case is stone blind. What is his perception level? Level of acceptance of his perceptions. Well, this has a tendency to sort of clear the air for the case and makes him kind of understand that maybe he wasn't the beast, the dog, the bum that everybody wanted him to believe. Now, let's mock up an unsuccessful man. See, and he mocks this up, and he mocks this up, and he mocks this up. You ask him, who's that acceptable to? He's telling you, life's been very unsuccessful. Who's he acceptable to? Not his father. Not his mother. Why? His grandmother. Bums coming to the rear door were the only ones who ever got fed and the only people she was ever nice to. Tramps. Well, boy, you blow a whole character right there like you pointed a demo cannon at it. There's nothing like this kind of recognition to teach your preclear what he's been up against so that he will be willing, a little more willing to be shot around. Now, he always will go on figuring, unless you run something like this, there's something really wrong with him that he's still hiding from the auditor. He's still hiding this man. Something really wrong with him. Because so on. Of course, the auditor's level of acceptance is assumed to be very, very sick and aberrated people. So very often you get somebody who's very anxious about being accepted. So they sit down on the couch, and the first doggone thing you know, they're just madder hatters. Doesn't matter how computational this is. The point is that the acceptance level of the auditor, according to the preclear, is somebody who's madder than a hatter. And they want processing, so they would simply act crazy. See how that is? You get this every year, a few cases. The fellow is acting much worse than he is. Yeah, you get it very interesting. And when we get to five, of course, we get exteriorization by scenery as simply change processing. Done and done and done and done and done and done. And it finally turns out to be real. And six, well, I don't know any handier process than recovering some certainty on the fact that he's been alive. And by that, he may be able to adjudicate that he will be alive. That's all we're really trying to do with it, one way or the other. And he can't have any anchor points in this universe, so let's have him have some anchor points in his own universe. So he can locate himself in his own universe anyway. You'll find that process three, run too hard on a very low step case, will just butcher them for a while. Feel their wits staggering. So you don't want to push it too hard. This fellow looks pretty shaky to you. We'll give him a little bit of self-analysis anyhow. Let him find a room before you lower the boom on him. Now we go into what room? We get just contact processing, which is physical contact processing. And we have talked a great deal about what you can do with various contacts, various viewpoints, people sitting in one chair and the other chair. You can go on and on with this process. And it gets back to step three again. All of this stuff keeps coming home to Rome. And Rome is step three. Because it has to do with space. There isn't any energy as such. But there is reduction and increase, banishment, and creation of space. Holding space steady and static. There's lots of space. That E-meter over the hair is made out of something which is there because it doesn't have any space in it compared to how much space it could have in it. So you have metal. And what's astonishing to the physicist continually is the fact there's much more space in this universe than there is matter. And he looks at an electron. Boy, he looks at those light years between the electron and the proton in comparison to the size of the electron and proton, and he gets really astonished. It's lots of space in the doggone electron. Well, he's scared to really look too close because he'd find it was all space. because he'd look in the electron and he'd find out that there was a lot of space inside the electron. He'd look in the proton, there's lots of space inside of the proton. Now he finds that this space, again, is demarked by electrons or something of the sort. They're probably would be called petatrons or be something learned like that. And he'd look in there and he'd discover that what these things were composed of was lots of space. In other words, he's just looking at space, 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 and each time finding the dimension. And he thinks he's looking for something. He isn't looking for anything. He isn't looking for anything. He's just looking for space. And the guy would only suddenly relax and say, gee, I'm looking at a lot of forms of space. His problems would fall away. They'd be solved. He's looking at forms and of space.
What he's trying to do is prove he's not a viewpoint.
You're right. That's a very good summation of what he's trying to do. Trying to prove he's not a new viewpoint. That's right. He's got to waste himself as a viewpoint to that level. And he's proved he's not a viewpoint. You ought to see those guys optically. You'd think that they were all equipped to go on the firing range with optical range finders when they start polishing up their glasses. Well, it's all gotten down to space. Now let's take space in the bracket. First, let's take the guy's own space and the other universe's space, and thus dispose of two universes simultaneously. And it would go like this. We would have the fellow, let's just use 8 anchor points for the thickness of it. Preachers don't have to have this, too. There's no scarcity of them. And this works, by the way, very well if you just start out using 8 anchor points. You don't have to work up to 8. But occasionally, if you ran into a case that was very resistive on the thing, theoretically and only theoretically, it might be best to start out with 2, 3, 4. Personally, I wouldn't do that. I'd just tell him, get 8 anchor points. He'd gasp and fume and fuss and say, well, get 8 black ones in the blackness. Well, hey, I could do that. He can do that. What do you suppose he's doing?